Matthew 27 is our Bible reading for this week, so we'd encourage you to get your Bible out and turn there with us. We'll run through the chapter today and hopefully answer some of your questions. If you've got other questions, we would love for you to submit them to us, and we will be glad to work on those. We are getting down to the end of the story.
Next to last week.
Yeah, and 27 is really just the crucifixion story.
Yeah.
It's like the chapter last week. It's a lengthy chapter, 66
right.
verses. That covers a lot of territory.
Focuses more on the Romans' role in what happened now.
And I do think it's especially important to remember that that Matthew isn't simply telling a story of what happened or trying to give a fact-by-fact detail of what happened.
Right.
He is telling his story from his perspective. And so he has collected events surrounding the death of Jesus that serve his purposes. And so there are a few things here. Most of the detail of the story is left out.
Yeah, you know, we assume that this is pure history, and so we want just the facts, or, you know, we assume we're reading this like a pure history, not that this didn't
Correct.
Happen. The Bible is concerned more with you getting the meaning out of what happened than all the details of what happened, and we forget that sometimes.
Yeah, we forget that it's telling a bigger story
yeah.
to which these are just
why
pieces.
Why does this matter?
Yes, yeah, and so I think we have to remember that Matthew is a contributor to the bigger story who has a purpose in that he is trying to serve. And it isn't, you know, like we would think of a biography that's going to lay out in consecutive order chronologically. It started with the birth, it ended with this, and
right.
all of that. So,
right.
And I think that becomes important when we start comparing the Gospels, because
right.
I'm sure a lot of you guys have encountered folks from time to time who allege that the gospel records are just full of contradictions. The writers don't agree with each other, and they try to line up evidence to support that. Even some episodes here in this chapter where allegedly the facts of the story don't quite line up. And so I think that it's important to remember that each writer has a purpose and is including details important to them, and that if you put all of that together, they're actually not contradictory. They're complementary and supplemental to each other.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's the bottom line, is just because things seem different does not mean they contradict. And again, when you remember the purpose of the Gospels is not straight historical, you know, recitation. This is not some sort of, you know, modern legal trial where the issue is to get the timeline just so, you know, for purely factual purposes. The Bible's goal is theological. It is to understand the meaning of what happened, not answer all the questions we have about what happened or how it happened.
Yeah, and I think that that's important for you guys to recognize that that even if everything lined up perfectly, that wouldn't satisfy the critics. They would just make the opposite argument. They would say, oh, look, each one is telling it exactly the same. Obviously, they colluded and lined up their stories, which, by the way, is what they do in the criminal justice system. If cops are interviewing two or three witnesses,
right,
and they all have exactly the same story, they're thinking, that sounds a little suspicious
well,
to me.
And what's funny about that, now that you put it that way, too, is, I mean, in some ways, this is no different than what Jesus and the disciples, apostles, dealt with, you know, back in the first century, which is, no matter what you do, no matter what sign you work, no matter what evidence you give, you know, you cast out demons while he's doing it by Satan's power. I mean, you know, no matter what sign you give, it's never enough, because it's not about evidence, it's about will.
Right.
You don't want to believe, and so I'm always going to find something to throw a rock at and twist it or miss the obvious because I simply don't want to accept.
I think you preached on that recently.
Once or twice.
All right, so the segment opens with kind of the end of the Judas story.
Yeah.
And one of the questions that comes up about Judas' part in this is whether or not Judas had free will here, whether or not he had the option, or is he just sort of pre-wired to betray Jesus because that's how the story is going to go. So
right.
What do we do with Judas' free will since this is how the story was supposed to go and he's a villain in it?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, maybe one way to do this, there's several ways I think you can wrestle with it. I think one way is maybe from lesser to greater. You know, so let's just talk about in humans. You know, those of us who have raised kids, you know, where you are, you know, when your kids are young, you can know what your kid's going to do in a certain scenario, which is why you keep them out of it. That doesn't mean you did it for them or forced them to do it. You just know your kid well enough to know if I put my 5-year-old in this situation, he's going to eat the, he's going to eat the marshmallow or whatever. Right. That's, the same thing. That's even, get up to adults, entrapment situations where somebody's legal defense is, the FBI entrapped me and, and so, the idea of putting people in situations where you know what they're going to do and that, so that's, you've got that, so if we get that with people just among ourselves, putting them as somebody in situations that take away their free will to do otherwise, it's just how much more God, knowing what we are, both can be true at the same time. God being so much greater, so much more beyond us, can know what somebody's going to do without forcing them to do it. He's so much higher than we are. If I, as a parent, can do that with my kid, how much more does that,
Right.
And then there's the other part of
it. Well, let me just chime in.
Yeah.
Foreknowledge is not foreordination.
Well, foreknowledge is not forcing somebody to do it. It's just right. Knowing somebody better than they know themselves.
Right.
And that's the other thing is, but to go back in a step more biblically now and really put it not on the human level, but theological, number one, God being so far above us, the rules of logic don't apply to God anymore. The law of gravity does. And so it's entirely possible when you're God outside the system to know something without forcing it to happen. The other thing to understand about this is the way God runs the world. You can see this in the Bible, from Pharaoh and Exodus all the way down. God runs the world in a way in which he draws out of us what's really in us. The truth about what's in our hearts and what we really are. That doesn't determine what we are. God just allows our lives to unfold and situations to happen and circumstances to occur that draw out the truth about what our heart really is. Because, again, we think it's about facts and evidence. If I'd had different facts or evidence, I made a different decision. The reality is it's about will. And because we don't accept that about human nature anymore, we don't understand that what God's really doing is teasing out of us what our will actually is and demonstrating it for all anybody with eyes to see. You may be blind because of your hard-heartedness about yourself, but God isn't, and God is running it in the way in which the righteous can see the truth about somebody. Judas was a thief. Judas was a corrupt man. Judas had issues. And God is just simply providentially allowing Judas to basically through circumstances, draw out what's the truth about the character of Judas Iscariot.
And absent foreknowledge, how could you have prophecy at all? God would have to know how history is going to map out to be able to declare in advance.
But ultimately, the most fundamental takeaway is with God, because the rules of logic do not apply, and that would limit God. God can know something without causing it to happen. And that's not possible for us in our limited minds, but that doesn't mean it's not possible for God.
So moving on, in verse 11, we pick up with Pilate's piece of this story.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about him? Why is this included? And it is a rather lengthy segment, roughly from verse 11, I guess, down to verse 26. We have this interaction of Jesus and Pilate. How do you think it advances Matthew's story?
Especially Matthew's story emphasizes the innocence of Jesus. Pilate is not nearly as, pardon the pun, fleshed out as he is perhaps in some of the other gospel accounts. But in Matthew, the relatively brief appearance he makes in Matthew's gospel, the key is actually all the way down in verse 24 when he, I am innocent of this man's blood, right. See to it yourselves. And they proclaim their guilt, which especially the way Matthew's gospel emphasizes the coming destruction of Jerusalem, right? Matthew 24, Jesus, all of that. And then Matthew 23, he weeps over Jerusalem. The fact that, in Matthew's account, the Jews emphasize, we'll take the guilt. Speaking more than they perhaps realized at the time.
Right.
But again, just this radical declaration of his innocence.
Yeah, you have that in verse 18, in fact. He knew because of envy they had handed him over. So Pilate, if nothing else, is perceptive.
Yeah.
And he sees what is going on here, but at the same time, he's extraordinarily weak and unwilling to stand up and do what is right. I think he's torn.
Oh, he's a politician. He's not. He rules by politics, not principle.
Yeah, well, and he's torn by his allegiances here, because on the one hand, he's at least at some level supposed to be loyal to justice and what is right. But on the other hand, his problem primarily for the Romans is to deal with the Jews and to keep them calm.
Well, see, and that's the key right there, because verse 24, when he saw a riot was about to start, and that's right, his real job description really isn't justice. His real job description, to your point, per Rome, is keep the Jews under control, because we know that they are a rebellious type group. They have a history of that. In fact, just a few decades later, they will rebel against Rome again. And so his real mandate is not justice from Rome. His real mandate is keep the peace.
The other thing that the story really draws out is how bent the Jews are on destroying Jesus. And absolutely his blood is on their hands, because there are a couple of places where Pilate gives him an exit ramp here, right?
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
It says, he's not guilty. I can release him because I'm accustomed doing this at the feast. And they don't take any of the exit ramps. They want him dead.
And again, that's why I think in Matthew's account, the emphasis there in that paragraph starting in verse 24 on everybody, in a sense, whether they really meant it or not, sometimes we speak more than we realize, but everybody, in a sense, acknowledges his innocence, his blood beyond. I mean, they just... and Pilate cows to the mob.
There are, as we move on through the story and we get into the actual crucifixion itself, there are some interesting things that take place down through here. One of the things that I think is interesting is the sign, verse 37, the charge that's put up above him. This is Jesus, King of the Jews. I don't think there's a dispute about it here, but there's a dispute recorded in other places. That is interesting that winds up being the charge put over his head.
Well, that's the only, other accounts emphasize this more, that, not only, Pilate, here, knows it's envy. Other places, when the Jews speak more to Pilate about, he's blaspheming, whatever, Pilate says, that's y'all's religion, that's y'all's law, that's not
It's almost like he's needling them with the charge he chooses.
Rome doesn't care about your religious squabbles, so they have to, to make this legitimate by Rome, you got to have something, And so again, insurrection, he's proclaiming himself to be king, even though, when Jesus is asked, my kingdom's not of this world, In fact, and again, other accounts where Pilate is more fleshed out, and Pilate and Jesus have more of a conversation. That's why Pilate knows that there's no merit to this. He's really not a threat to Rome. Whatever he means by when he calls himself a king, he's not threatening Rome in real time, as far as Rome would see it at that point.
Right.
But the only way you can legitimate from where Pilate's sitting at, to do this is you've got to charge him with something that Rome would care about.
Yeah. Yeah, and the fact that ends up being what's over his head.
But again, speaking more than they realize.
Yeah, it's
because he is the son of David. He is the heir to David's throne, though not on earth. But the whole, the irony of it all.
Well, that makes me wonder about verse 43. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he delights in him.
Right.
Because God will rescue.
Well, again, speaking more than they realize.
I wonder
because he doesn't
that,
just
yeah.
deliver him. He delivers him with, as Paul will call it in one of his letters to Timothy, by the power of an indestructible life, a qualitatively different resurrection to the mortal life, with a body that's liable to be killed and crucified. He will be more than delivered. Death will have no power over him permanently in the end.
Yeah.
Not just saving him from this moment where, Jesus could, still die of an old man or something down the road. God will deliver in a spectacular way.
So some people get tripped up by the citation of verse 46. My God, why have you forsaken me?
Right.
As though Jesus is issuing a complaint to God from the cross.
Right.
That he is forsaken. And that actually gives us an opportunity to unpack a broader Bible principle about how we handle these Old Testament citations.
Right. When the Old Testament is especially explicitly quoted or alluded to, for that matter, as often as not, you need to go back and you need to read the whole context. They didn't have chapter and verse divisions back then. A lot of times, lines would be cited and it would assume the whole context.
Right.
And so,
and that does make sense. Someone's citing a verse here.
Yeah.
The verse is supposed to be understood in context.
Right.
And yet, sometimes I think we just do that straight line approach. My God, why have you forsaken me? That's a prophecy back here in this Psalm 22. And that's as far as we go. We just look at the citation. Yeah.
Though the irony is, again, you read all of Psalm 22, and other gospel accounts will emphasize more other aspects of Psalm 22, some, the dividing of the clothes, just a variety of things. That will also be come out of that psalm be alluded to. But the big thing about the psalm is, you know, what Jesus may well be meaning is not just God has forsaken me, but, you know, in this moment it looks that way, may feel that way humanly. But the whole psalm emphasizes that God does deliver at the end, to your point, the line just before, if God delights in them, he'll deliver him. Psalm 22, God does deliver the person right. who cries that opening line. And the psalm goes on to say that, you know, the voice of the psalm goes on to say originally, you know, that basically I will declare, you know, God's praise, God's power, God's goodness in the congregation, in the assembly, in the end, as you know, in the sense Jesus will be raised from the dead to be able to do, as he, you know, acknowledges God to his disciples who are now becoming apostles and beginning to have a light bulb go off.
It's almost more than just being a quote from the psalm.
It's a script.
It's
script for the whole event.
It's a footnote. Go back and read the whole book or the whole passage, and that'll tell you what I'm thinking right now.
This and if is you want to understand more deeply what's really going on, this is a framework in which to interpret, to understand the significance of what's happening.
Okay, so moving on down through the rest of this context. There are this whole collection of events that take place around the time that Jesus died. All of them bear significant, the veil of the temple being torn, the rock shaken.
Right.
But surely what is the most curious of all of this is 52 and 53, where the tombs are open.
And unique to Matthew. This is another one of those that only Matthew, as I recall,
Well, there you
says.
Go.
Yeah.
And these resurrected bodies appear.
Mm-hmm.
So what's special about this detail that Matthew plugs in for us at this point?
I think it works, especially, I mean, Matthew being, you know, we typically, you know, he's more Jewish and whatnot. I think a couple of things and why Matthew wants us to know this happened. Number one, it's a bit of foreshadowing of what this death is accomplishing.
Right.
The tombs will be open and the righteous will come back. You know, I mean, there will be a general resurrection of the
victory
dead.
Victory over death is coming for everyone.
But that's right. But especially for the righteous, it will be a resurrection to life, not a resurrection to damnation. And so it's a little bit of a foreshadowing of what this death is really accomplishing, not to mention his own and just a couple of, you know. But beyond that, especially in the Jewish world, you know, the idea of a cloud of witnesses that bear witness to, you know, the prophecies, God's fulfillment, God's faithfulness, that matters in the Jewish world, right? And so the righteous dead who have everything from, you know, long to see this day, so to speak, you know, some of whom may have prophesied it, you know, those to whom, you know, inherited the promises but never saw them fulfilled, just this whole idea of a cloud of witnesses from the past that can now, you know, in a sense testify, bear witness to the fact that what God has promised and what has long been patiently waited for has finally come. And so I think it works on a couple different levels.
Victory over death.
Victory over death with a cloud of witnesses to proclaim God is faithful. Yeah.
So just a quick word to parents and thinking about working this passage with your kids. I mean, this is the climactic moment with chapter 28 of the Bible story. And boy, if there's anywhere in the Bible you really want your kids to know what the text says, this is a great place to work. So what an opportunity to sit down with your kids and just kind of rehearse again the story of Jesus and this final climactic moment where he dies on the cross to deliver us from sin. So take some time this week to be sure that they read the story and hear it from God himself, what it was that Jesus has come to accomplish.